Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Today is the 24th anniversary of this radio program. To celebrate its founding, I am presenting a speech from 1984 that was the precursor to American Dissident Voices. In 1984, I was a 28-year-old broadcast engineer. I'd been working with Dr. William Pierce, the founder of the Alliance, for 2 years. I had designed and installed a security system for the National Office. I had compiled, edited, and published a book, The Best of Attack and National Vanguard, and I was in the process of adding audio recordings to our then-fledgling bookselling operation. It was nearing the Labor Day weekend, the date we'd scheduled for the Alliance's 7th General Convention. Dr. Pierce asked me to think about how the Alliance could utilize media more effectively to spread our message, and then to present my ideas as a speech at the convention. I had never spoken in public before. I can't even describe to you how nervous that made me. But I wasn't about to let Dr. Pierce down. The mission of the Alliance was my life's mission now. I said yes, and this speech is the result. 7 years later, the ideas that were born that summer day came to fruition, and American Dissident Voices was founded. So let's go back in time to late summer 1984 and join that National Alliance meeting and listen to Mastering Media.
I'm extraordinarily proud to be speaking before the convention of the National Alliance. Let me introduce you to a typical white American family circa the 1950s. Tom and Betty Jones live in Kansas City, where Tom works for the local Buick agency and Betty is a school teacher. They have 3 young children, Mike, Susan, and Dumont. Dumont is the newest addition to the Jones family, and he is no normal child. Dumont is a deluxe 15-inch diagonally measured 18-tube all-channel TV with automatic fine-tuning and dual-speaker hi-fi sound. Though the proud parents lavish more attention upon Dumont than upon Mike and Susan combined, the children aren't jealous at all. Every member of the family is unanimously in love with the glowing box. When Susan came down with tonsillitis, her main complaint was that she had to miss all her favorite shows. And when Mike behaved particularly badly one day, he received the ultimate punishment: no TV tonight. How boring Tom and Betty's life must have been before television. Before they could laugh with Milton Berle, ride the range with Matt Dillon, and understand world events with Edward R. Murrow and John Cameron Swayze. Now every night and many a weekend at the Jones home begins with a cheerily anticipatory warm-up hum and ends with the lonesome disappearing dot. And between those two events, the highest paid behavior modification men in the world go to work on the Joneses. To leave out politics, I might add that Tom drinks the beer, drunk by all men who realize you only go around once in life. Betty uses the detergent that puts a giant in your washing machine. Mike and Susan drink the soft drink with the mystical phrase, "You like it, it likes you," on every bottle. And Tom smokes the cigarette for the man who thinks for himself. Well, it isn't so much that these ad campaigns make any sense. Even today, when the dancing mulattoes sing, "Coke is it," does anybody know what they're talking about? It's just that the products are on television and are therefore real. Tom and Betty didn't know it, but there is something profoundly, perhaps fatally sick about a society in which the most powerful medium for communication and education is largely devoted to the endless repetition of inane slogans promoting mindless consumerism as the ultimate reality. This ultimate reality, this electronic reality, is often more real to us than our own surroundings. The average American has long had a certain respect for anything he sees in print. In the old canard, the bumpkin says, they couldn't print it if it wasn't so. Today's global village bumpkin knows it so. He saw it last night on television. And more importantly, he knows what isn't so. He hasn't seen it on television. The media experience is, to be sure, a powerful and intoxicating one. One can travel to the corners of the earth, witness awesome athletic feats, watch historical military clashes, and be continually surrounded by the latest and hippest entertainers, musicians, comedians, and professional talkers, all from the contoured comfort of a lazy boy recliner with an endless supply of beer and potato chips within easy reach. It's just so easy. It's no wonder that Americans have bought the TV lifestyle and the not-so-subtly injected Jewish TV philosophy lock, stock, and barrel. It is so easy to become, as one avowedly pro-TV organization calls its members, couch potatoes. So easy and so deadly. Let's visit the Joneses again in the 1980s. Tom sells Toyotas now. Betty has retired from her teaching job and works twice a week at the YWCA, counseling young blacks in an unemployment workshop. They're very proud of the fact that they've sponsored a Nigerian boy and two Laotian girls as part of their membership in World Vision International, which they watch faithfully every week. They had wanted more children themselves, but Steve Allen and Sally Struthers convinced them that the sponsorship route was better. Young Mike combined his interests in rock music and photography and is now one of the official photographers for the Michael Jackson Victory Tour. Never occurs to him, of course, to ask, victory over what? His parents are proud as can be. Their daughter, Susan, married well, or married into prosperity, as they say. Her husband is Daniel Leibowitz. He's the top writer for one of the best New York ad agencies. He makes over $60,000 a year, and he's best known for his singing toilet paper commercials. The Joneses haven't had much to say to their neighbors these past few years. They just don't know them too well anymore. The funny thing is, they really don't have much to say to each other either. Goes without saying that they have as much racial consciousness as Phil Donahue. It's very sad. I think the facts that explain the plight of the Joneses and the millions of more or less TV-burned families in media-dominated America is firstly that we only have so much room in our minds for current reality information, and our modern media flood us, overload us with such an avalanche that our own experiences, our own thoughts, and what truth might be out there can be crowded out of our consciousness. For example, the Holocaust is real. It is the subject of ceaseless wailing, howling, and docudramas. The mulattification and mestizofication of our own women, our own blood, that you can see 100 times a day on these streets, is not real. By not reporting it, by its absence from the overwhelming din of news glaring and blaring from every screen and speaker in the land, the Jews have turned the impending death of our race into a non-event. It's not happening. Secondly, I believe there is only so much room in our hearts for primary human experience. The more precious minutes of our short lives we spend in communion with the deodorant pitchmen, the fewer we have to spend with our families and those whom we truly love. A generation has grown up in an environment in which, when the family is together, they are listening not to one another, but to the Jew on the tube. You cannot let Don Rickles into your heart without crowding something else out. It's a grim picture. But a question we must ask ourselves is, are the electronic media, and with that term I mean television and all its component parts, the cinema, the radio, recorded music, etc., are they irredeemably flawed, and are they destructive in and of themselves? To gain a better picture of what these ubiquitous media really are and to whom they really belong, let us go back to their origin. Throughout the 19th century, scientists in several European countries experimented with electromagnetic waves, which appeared to travel easily through space or through the theoretical ether. Michael Faraday, James Clerk Maxwell, and Oliver Lodge were the best-known names among the men who laid down the foundation of theory upon which others expanded into the practical application of sending messages through the air. Guglielmo Marconi, then a very young man, read of these experiments in 1894 and soon after began experimenting with wireless communication. By 1896, he was able to send a Morse code message over a distance of 2 miles. He left his native Italy for Britain in search of both scientific and financial assistance, and with the aid of the Crown and a group of British investors, established the Marconi Wireless Company, which in 1897 and 1898 installed radio communications equipment on several ships of the British Navy. All of this, of course, was strictly point-to-point, two-way communication in Morse code. Around the same time, a Canadian by the name of Reginald Aubrey Fessenden made a proposal to the U.S. Department of Agriculture that he would find and develop a method of transmitting weather information by wireless. Fessenden had worked at the Edison Laboratories and had been a professor of electrical engineering at Western University. One of his ideas was to find a way to transmit a human voice over the air. At the time, a knowledge of Morse code was required in order to use the wireless. Voice transmission would make it usable for all. His first short-range experiments in 1901 proved successful, and so with the backing of Pittsburgh financiers, and with technical assistance from Swedish-born scientist Ernst Alexanderson, he formed the National Electric Signaling Company. And on Christmas Eve, 1906, Fessenden shocked radio telegraph operators on ships and at coastal stations across the nation, when, as they pressed their earphones closer to their heads in amazement and astonishment, instead of the usual dits and dahs emanating from their headsets came a faint human voice, Fessenden's voice, wishing them a Merry Christmas, followed by a brief explanation of his sending station, and then the strains of Greensleeves, played by Fessenden himself on his violin on that winter night. A second broadcast conducted on New Year's Eve, 1907, was picked up by United Fruit Company ships in the West Indies. The Fessenden experiments were an unqualified success. Lee DeForest, an American who in 1899 wrote a PhD dissertation at Yale on Hertzian waves, had also experimented on his own with several wireless devices. In 1902, DeForest formed with several well-to-do friends the DeForest Wireless Telegraph Company. Like the other experimenters at the time, DeForest, who would later invent the vacuum tube, was still thinking of wireless as a means of communication, a radio telephone. For the moment, however, his equipment had to be tested, and for that purpose he installed receivers at several locations and at the transmitter, obtained some phonograph records and a player, and sent music over the air. This broadcast, and the term broadcast means The signal was sent to whomever could receive it and not to some specific person. Was the first by DeForest, and it took place in 1917. DeForest himself, who died in 1961, later conceded he did not realize the importance of his accomplishment at the time. The point of my telling you all this is to give you a taste of the romance and the excitement these white scientists and experimenters must have experienced in their journeys into the unknown, and to make it clear just who created this technology. As with nearly every other advance in man's upward struggle, the electronic media are at their root a consequence of European man's Faustian urge to discover and to know and to master, and of the genius and the will and the labor of the individual white men who gave birth to this technology. In a very real sense, it belongs to us. This electronic extension of man's ability to speak, this hardware that extend man's senses a millionfold, this collective, ethereal supercortex that surrounds the world and binds men together, and which just maybe is an early step towards conscious direction of our own evolution. This power is by all rights ours, for we created it. It is true, of course, that the creative work having been largely accomplished by the end of the 1920s, that the money men and the monopolists, many of them Jews, moved into broadcasting as they had moved into Hollywood many years earlier. And it's a very telling fact that for virtually all of their existence, the three largest radio and television networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, have been headed by Jews. The names are familiar to you. Sarnoff, Paley, Goldenson. The litany of Jewish names and positions of control of our media environment does not need to be reiterated here. Suffice it to say that it is a litany of pain and despair, of unending misfortune and eternal regret, a litany of the executioners of white America. White Americans allowed their attitudes to be molded, their spirits deformed, and their minds stunted by the alien persuaders. And what else, really, could we expect? The mass of people are very adaptable and easily swayed. They will often come to like or believe they like whatever is put in front of them. Can one imagine a healthy 13-year-old girl in a white environment swooning for a loathsome mulatto like Prince without having been subjected to an intense media campaign beforehand? The Jews understand this very well. Not all of us are leaders. For a race to survive, more followers must be born than leaders. And so the actions of the mass are determined by the attitudes engendered in them by others and in their surroundings. This is natural. But in a healthy society, those others would be the best men, the natural leaders of the race. And it is my contention that the nucleus of this class of leaders is sitting in this room at this very moment. And it is also my contention that the new media are far, far from being detrimental to our race in the long run. Rather, they represent our greatest opportunity, an opportunity for us to reach more and more of our brothers and sisters with our message and to tear off their blindfolds as they stand on the narrow ledge between a pinnacle and an abyss. It is up to us to act so this historic opportunity is not lost. How many of you have seen Jim Baker, a television evangelist? Now, he may be loathsome and abhorrent, but let us give credit where credit is due. He's one of the most powerful and influential men in the religion business. He heads a multi-million dollar empire of real estate, radio, and television. And the man started out with a couple of reel-to-reel tape recorders. We can do it too. The advent of home video And local access cable channels in cities and towns across the country represent a small but discernible chink in the walls of Jewish censorship, which enclose the minds of our people today. At first, it may be through such means that the Alliance message is spread, but as our skills and capabilities increase, as the available technology becomes more powerful, as our message brings others to join hands with us, there really will be no limit to what we can do. Admittedly, we are just starting down this road. We're just beginning to expand into new media. But that's okay. After all, if we were handed the control of television in this country on a silver platter at this moment, I don't know how well we'd be able to handle it. Our growth into these roles will progress in a natural, evolutionary manner. Witness the first step, the step that's already been taken in this growth, the first step into new media for the Alliance. We just experienced it. The establishment of a body of Alliance music by several very gifted Alliance members. Those who have heard and joined in the singing of such songs as Race of Beauty, Whites Unite, White Men Rise, and the other Alliance songs have felt a sense of community, a sense of belonging, and a sense of our sacred mission on this lonely little planet of ours that mere prose cannot convey. Tonight, at our film presentation, you will see a second important step in our mastery of new media, as well as a look into the past to see an inspiring example of what can be done. It has occurred to me that the religious are undoubtedly right when they claim that even the greatest human achievements are empty and void of meaning unless seen in the larger sense of a cosmic purpose, an eternal whole. And I think the skeptics are also right when they claim that any meaning we find in this existence will be the meaning we create by the agencies of our will and our power. We of the National Alliance have a mission of eternal significance. If our race is to overcome the extinction our enemies have planned for it, we must have the will to expel the Jew from that holiest of holy places, the mind and soul of white humanity, and replace his filthy lies with the certainty that while our hearts beat, we shall never relent, we shall never pause, we shall never hesitate in our pursuit of the vision expressed so well in Race of Beauty. Deeds and thoughts of all the past perish not while thou dost last. Greater men and glory still shall thy endless future fill. To which I can only add, amen. Thank you.
You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance. This week, we are offering a collection of the very best of Dr. William Pierce's speeches and radio addresses, entitled William Pierce, The Power of Truth, Volume 1. This MP3 CD collection includes over 8 hours of the most powerful and moving words you are likely to hear in your lifetime. To receive your copy of William Pierce, The Power of Truth, Volume 1, simply visit natall.com and click on CD offer. That's natall.com and click on CD offer. Or send $16 each, or $50 for five copies, to National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Once again, that's $16 for one, or $50 for five copies, to Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to never give up.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes will rise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes will rise as we shout.